All right, today is April 21st, 2015. This is the fourth interview with Dr. Tom Archdeacon. We are here in his office inside the Mossy Humanities Building. My name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Tom, to make sure I get the sound quality as good as I can you say your name and spell your last name?
Yeah. Thomas Archdeacon, A-R-C-H-D-E-A-C-O-N.
Great. So as I said before I turned on the recorder, I have a few more questions about your time here on campus. These are in no particular order, just sort of thoughts that I had or questions that I had.
Okay.
Maybe one more thing about what, if any, influence the military had on your time here, and that's in regards to the seminar class you taught on the Korean War.
Well, it's particularly in regard to that. Likewise, a class I taught on, seminar I taught on World War I, and actually, certainly not in my immigration courses very much, although when I was teaching a survey course or a post-1945 course where I did, I made sure to give the important wars some analysis beyond simply their political ramifications. I didn't go over hill and through dale with the generals, at least, but I identified the major campaigns, the major battles, why the timing fell in the way it did, or whatever. And I did that in part because I think that some members in the department had developed a reputation for, when it came to these military aspects of the wars, just ignoring them or passing them off. And I didn't, you know, everyone has their own choice about what to do, but my choice was at least to give a modest amount of coverage. And then with something like the Korean War or World War I, although I would say in both of those I probably covered the military aspects, again, not in detail, but with some greater than average level of attention. With the Korean War, it moves in various stages between 50 and 53 of the North Korean invasion, and then our American drive up to, or United Nations drive up to the Chinese border and the Chinese intervention and a few things. So, I mean, each phase of it we spent some time on and read in particular and why it was going this way or that way. And with World War I, I found myself covering mostly the European side, surprising at the sector, that I didn't deal that much. I mean, I gave the Americans sort of proportional interest in that they come into the war so late. And part of my motivation for covering those things were the Korean War. It was the 50th anniversary, and it was sort of people all over, not simply at Wisconsin, were saying, well, gee, this is the forgotten war they were referring to it as, and I thought it'd be good that it not be forgotten. So that World War I, it again seemed an opportunity. The 100th anniversary coming around, it piqued my interest in it. I mean, part of this is selfish. I wanted to know more about these events as well. And so I thought that would be it. Now, as it turns out, there's a lot of people giving a lot of coverage to various aspects of World War I, and I think there's certainly no shortcoming of, if I hadn't done the Korean War, probably nobody would have done the Korean War. It appears that several people are interested in World War I, including people who probably know more about, certainly about Europe, than I, at that time, than I do. Mm-hmm. So that, I think that I, you know, it started off with a good intention. I think it concluded with the same, but probably in terms of the idea that I was stepping in to fill a gap that wouldn't otherwise be filled, I think I was probably, I exaggerated the need for it in that regard. But it was fine. It was, you know, a couple of years I taught that course. And it was to a freshman group who wouldn't likely get it otherwise. And, yeah, so fine.
Okay.
There's a question that I didn't put on my list that I want to ask now, and that's committee work. I noticed on your CV you had several committees that you served.
Oh, yeah. No, I served on lots of committees. I mean, I wouldn't say that... People have told me that I, you know, I think one of the nicer things people have said about me is that over time I showed a willingness to carry my share of the department labor, and I didn't try to shirk committee responsibilities. So maybe I don't, you know, I wouldn't say that I did a greater job than most people. I probably did a little bit more than some people, but I try to make sure I made my contribution in the running of the department, and I did serve as chair, and I did serve on some interesting committees like the Executive Committee for Social Sciences and Research Committee and the like, which are important committees, and I was happy to do that. I've been on a number of search committees and the like, you know, but it's, I think you find a lot of people, sort of, a lot of people would have a similar profile of committee service. I'm not unique in the department among that, although I guess I would say, when people ask me to serve, I usually said yes, and so maybe I ended up on a few more than some people did, but wouldn't go overboard with that claim.
The people I've interviewed who have been on committees talk about the intangibles they might have gotten out of it. By that I mean being able to meet people outside of your...
Yeah, no, I think that would probably do mostly when you were on, let's say, a committee to review another department. You sort of saw how that department functioned. And usually you're dealing with people who are not members of that department as well, at least the committee members. When we served on the divisional committee and the research committee, I found those very important learning experiences. There is a kind of catch-22 to it in that to get on those committees, you have to be around long enough to have established some kind of presence on campus, or at least for somebody to say, God, he's been here forever, it's about time he did some work. But on the other hand, then when you get on them and you sort of see these different perspectives and like, you say, gee, I wish I had been on this committee 10 years earlier, because at that point it might really have made a difference in the way I appreciated stuff or understood. And it's a question of seeing different research perspectives, different expectations regarding scholarship, and I don't just mean the amount of scholarship or things, just the way different disciplines approach research questions and the like. I found that kind of informative, and indeed even serving, let's say, on the research committee or on the executive committee, when people's work is coming up for review oftentimes in fields, well, they're not really in fields that you have no feel for because it's within your division, but fields in which, you know, I don't do economic research in a substantial way, but I would be serving with economists or reviewing the work of economists. And, well, you just sort of grow a little bit intellectually because you're exposed to this in a way that your own work typically wouldn't require you to allow, or your own work wouldn't encourage, maybe.
Okay.
So,
You were department. You mentioned you were department head. It's in your CV.
Yeah.
You were department head. So the first question is, you know, why department head when you were?
It was a combination. I imagine personal ambition in a way, just why not me? Why not I? At one level. Again, a sense that given my age at the time, given sort of the rotation, and not a formal rotation, but who had been serving recently, what fields, not that they represented those fields as chair, but the areas out of which they came, was I of the right generation to be giving this kind of service? Was I offering, coming from the American side, would it be a little bit different perspective on the department from the ones that my predecessors had and like? Those factors influenced my going after. And I think I was, the vote for me was, I forget what it was. It was 30, maybe I don't forget it. Somehow the number 37-1 stretches. And the person I know who voted for another candidate, and he was a fellow who was not hostile to me in any way. He just thought this other person wanted it. And I think that person certainly became chair after me. I can't remember right now whether he became chair immediately after me or not. I think he did, but it was a question. It was a logical alternative, and I didn't read any animus to me in that. It was a person who was working part of the time outside of the department and the like, and I guess he didn't hear the scuttlebutt in the halls that Archdeacon is willing to serve. Why don't we give him a chance? Mm-hmm. So. I also was on leave at the time that the chair election was, and it was nice in a way to be running for it and not have to be around. I just mm-hmm. let people know, well, if you want me to serve, I'd be willing to serve. Maybe it's an appropriate time for me to do it. And usually, there's enough. Usually these chair elections are not kind of hotly contested over time. You get a sense, well, there are a number of people who've had their appropriate experience and who's willing to serve at this moment, and we usually sort that out fairly quickly and without a great deal of mm-hmm. dispute. It was only in my time here, I only remember one real sort of race for the department chair where the two candidates represented different sort of, I don't know if political is even too strong a word. It was more sort of two visions of the department and in contest with one another. And it turned out that even in that case, it was just a matter of the order in which these two people would serve. It was one person served, and then the person who was the loser in the prior set of elections served right after that person. So it even that did not represent something fundamental. It was just a question of whose turn, whose turn was it, whose way of looking at the department fits what we want to do in the short run. Right. Nothing super, super serious, although mm-hmm. people got serious about it at the moment.
Sure. Since we don't know who will listen to this and in what context, I wonder if you could
Assuming nobody, never.
I wonder if you could take a few more minutes and talk about some of the key things that you did or the key things in general that a department head would do in history at during the time you were serving.
The big thing is sort of you have to keep searches running, okay? You have to keep searches running. You have to oversee those and create reasonable committees to accomplish the goals of those searches. And likewise, other committees that you create, you have to have some imagination on who will work well and whom can you get on the committee, who will work well with others, represent a variety of views, and yet not be so hard line as that it's that person's way or the highway on the committee. So that's that's one responsibility. And there were a couple of contentious searches when I was chair. There was one over Women's History was expanding. They were looking for a history of European women, and we had one search that just collapsed because people couldn't agree on a candidate. I mean, that search later was rerun and rerun successfully, I think after I had left. But that was one of those things. That was a bit of a disappointment. Most searches went fine. There was a search while I was on for a person teaching Native American history, which was a big, not an issue for us, but it was an expansion of our coverage. And that we did, that went through, and the person stayed for several years and then moved on to Yale. So probably a reasonably successful search. I also happened to be chair at a time when the department underwent what's called a 10-year review. Every 10 years, departments are supposed to be. Now, it turns out that often the time schedule on these things falls behind. The dean has to review the departments or has a practice of doing it, and I think in our case it had actually been much longer than 10 years since we had been reviewed. And that requires an awful lot of pulling together of information about the department and what it's accomplished, what it's failed to accomplish, how its students are doing, mm-hmm. what the composition of the faculty looks like, how the faculty has changed over time. So that was a big issue. There were some budget issues that came up while I was chair. I mean, I was fortunate in many respects because at that time the university had what was called, or at least the college had what was called delegated budgets, where the dean really gave a certain pile of money to each department to spend, not willy-nilly, but more or less we had a great deal of control over it. And the times were I remember I put up at a department meeting once a photocopy of a cartoon from the New Yorker, and it's some kind of cocktail party and people are talking to each other and one is saying to the other, well, they're Wisconsin rich. So it wasn't that we were really flush, but in comparison with what we're used to, mm-hmm. we had some control over funds, and I sort of made a push at that point for people to be getting computers in their offices and for us to have email and things of that nature. That this building was far behind technologically what other, at least what the only other building with which I had a good deal of experience was social science when I had run that data and computation center. And I sort of saw what people in sociology and economics had as standard equipment, and we had none of this. So it wasn't that the administration was against it, but it was just that made it enough of priority to. So it was a question of having the desire plus a good moment in the budget plus everybody, the momentum had gotten such with computers that the idea of people not having access to computers in their office was strange by that point. We had reached the tipping point. So it was fortuitous in part. So that came around. I began the process of putting the old folks on the ice floe where I find myself at the moment, in that we had a tradition of just sort of leaving emeritus professors in their offices after they retired, and so all the best offices were being held by people who no longer really had teaching responsibilities, and in some cases weren't showing up very much. And because we started to run out of room and the dean was losing patience with us, I got in a position where I said, we have to pull the trigger on this and start moving the emeriti into off the prime offices and perhaps have them share offices. Now, what we originally started with was putting two in an office, finding two people who could stand each other or had complementary work patterns and putting them together, and putting them usually on an inside office without the street view, and doing that. So, and there wasn't, we're dealing with mature people, and there wasn't a great deal of resistance to that. Some said, well, I'm surprised I was able to keep it this long, or whatever. So, but that was a change. Now, of course, it's accelerated, so the emeriti are now in a, all kind of in a single office, and part of it reflects just the growth of the growth of the department in the last 15 years or so. We had something, I guess, I wouldn't overstate it, but the dean was concerned. We had a very good relationship for a long time with the what was called the Ratification Project, what is still called the Ratification Project. They are doing the papers of the First Continental, the first federal elections and the ratification of the Constitution. And they were independent of us, but housed in the History Department. And we indirectly were responsible for their budget, because the money came through the department, even though we did not provide the money for them or raise it for them or anything. Nominally, if there were problems with that, ultimately it was our responsibility. And the dean was getting concerned about the books on the accounts were not in really good shape, and the dean was concerned about that. So I began the process of getting the relationship, not so much the relationship of the department with it, but the financial relationship of the department with these projects straightened out. It wasn't fully resolved by the time I finished being chair, but we had made progress, and then in the next few years we sort of came up with a better system of keeping watch over the flow of money and keeping their money separate from ours, and giving the proper accounting that the dean and the federal authorities wanted. So I think those were probably the big not untypical of the kind of problems that chairs in general have to handle, were illustrative of the particular problems that came up in my set of years. Mm-hmm. So it's budget issues, it's handling of personnel in various ways, whether it's making hires or finding space for them, figuring out which hires to make, setting priorities, running committees, trying to make sure that you maintain the chairs. In some schools, the chair is really a creature of the dean. And I think technically here, even the chair is a creature of the dean, in the sense that the department sees itself as electing the chair. But what the department actually does is it recommends somebody to the dean to be chair, and the practice is that the dean never or virtually never goes against the department's recommendation. But in theory, you are, you are in effect a creature of the dean on one hand. Mm-hmm. But from the department's point of view, you are the representative of the department to the dean and to the broader university. And so you do have to be a bit of a broker. I mean, I think most of us see ourselves as our permanent ties are with the department, our tie to the dean is more temporary, but we do whatever our instincts toward the department may be. We try to be honest brokers. We, come back and say, well, from the dean's perspective, these are the things that have to be achieved, and these are the real problems that he or she is facing, and how can we work within the context? And then on the other hand, you're going up to the dean and telling him or her that these are our real problems, and this mm-hmm. is what we're trying to do, and what flexibility can you offer us mm-hmm. in order to do it?
One more thing about being department chair, and maybe this is also is a general question, and that's your relationship with history department staff.
Well, you deal with the staff. We've had a good staff here. We had one. I had one. For the most part, the dealing with the staff was not a problem. I'd say the relationship between the staff and the faculty has, in my opinion at least, traditionally been a pretty good one. The staff seem ready to do the work that's requested of them, and I think the faculty recognize that the staff play a very important support role for which they're not terribly well compensated. I mean, not that the faculty are rolling in dough either, but obviously if you take a look at the salary structure, the professors represent a substantial step up from most of the members there. And yet I think those kinds of differences in status and compensation and the like don't generate the kind of resentment that they could if both sides didn't work to make the working environment or didn't try to make the working environment as congenial as possible. Now, I did, as chair, have one really unfortunate crisis, and I'm going to, for the privacy of people involved, I'm going to speak about it in fairly vague terms, certainly no terms by which you could identify somebody. But there was a member of the staff who was misusing computer resources and viewing inappropriate material while during the workday and after the workday and the like. And I have to admit that when I was at home one morning and I got a call from the provost, John Wiley, and whom I knew and in various contexts, and John said to me, I need to talk to you about something, what's up? And I said, well, I'm just here, I got a class at, I forget, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, sometime. I'm just trying to get the class ready for when I come in this afternoon. I said, where are you, John? He said, I'm sitting in your office chair. And I said, oh, then I knew it wasn't good news. And he said that somebody had turned in a complaint and that he was basically down in the office ordering computers to be seized. And so then you go, what do? You go into full cooperation mode and the like. And that was a tremendous disappointment, because the person who was involved in this wrongdoing was a very good worker and had made substantial, it was a staff member who had made substantial contributions to the department, and whom I had, and a chair before me, when that person was hired, had, you know, implicit trust in. I think everyone had trust in, and then all of a sudden to have this blow up was unfortunate. The police eventually got involved, and the person was charged and lost their job. And I think as it ultimately resolved, the person left Madison and didn't do any jail time or anything like that, but had to go into rehabilitation or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, that then created a high level of concern in the department. So that was something I had to deal with. Mostly I dealt with it by cooperating fully with the investigation, which meant basically getting out of the investigator's way, and then, you know, trying to keep members of the department informed insofar as the legal situation permitted and the like, and trying to reassure people in the department who found, I mean, obviously this was stuff of a sexual nature, and in particular it involved child pornography, and there were I think everybody was concerned, but, you know, some people saw, you know, well, everyone was concerned. Some people were militantly concerned, mm-hmm. and making sure that everybody knew that the situation, no one's going to sweep it under the rug, the situation was going to be dealt with appropriately, there was going to be no interference with it, no special favors, no nothing, and that we'd get through this, and, you know, that became the responsibility of the chair, and everybody, I think once people received those assurances that this wasn't going to be laughed off or excuses weren't going to be made and there was going to be no cover-up or, you know, anything of that nature, that the department went along very, mm-hmm. as a crisis of that nature goes, it seemed to have minimal repercussions.
So I want to ask about an external event that happened either just after you finished department chair or during the last year, and that was 9/11?
That was after I was department chair.
I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind just talking sort of your general memories of the event.
Well, my general memories of the event was I was on leave, and I was in upstate New York in a rural area, and I went to a dump that morning because it was a landfill or a transfer station, because I had some stuff I had to take care of. We were, like, you know, getting ready to come back to Madison a little bit later than we usually did, but still within the time limit. And so I went there, and people had a black and white television on at the landfill, and it was right between when the first building was hit and the second building was hit. So right at that point where it wasn't totally clear what was happening. I think the second building was hit, maybe it was hit already, or it just might have been hit right that moment or while I was there or moments later. The situation became clear fairly quickly, but it was, whoa, this, what's going on kind of thing. It was a shock. And my immediate concerns, I mean, outside of the people there, where I started thinking, and at the time my son, who's a doctor, was an intern in New York, and I was wondering whether he'd be involved in it or not. He turned out he wasn't. I guess he volunteered services, but none were needed at that point, at least they had enough volunteers. One of my daughters worked at a building, at the tallest building in Los Angeles, which made me wonder about what was going on there, you know, if you start, because this was at the point where they didn't know whether there were going to be more of these things or what, and what were the likely targets. And I guess they closed her building that day or something by the time we found out. And my third child, another daughter, was working at a nuclear power plant in the San Diego area, right next to Camp Pendleton. And when we got in touch with her, the Marines were on the base having taken over the power plant to protect it. So you know, finding out what was going on with kith and kin was kind of the first thought. Then I came back to Madison a couple of days later, and I had heard stuff, and actually at that point, I guess there had been a meeting in the department, and the graduate students, I didn't hear this directly, I was just told, had been denouncing the U.S. government and the like. And at that point, I was glad I was on leave, and I simply left town for another month or two because I didn't figure there was anything constructive I was going to accomplish here, and I was pretty sick of the place. Mm. So,
so how does it compare in your memory then to a sort of another pivotal date in U.S. history, and that was the day that President Kennedy was shot?
The day that President Kennedy was shot, I was in a college classroom. It was in a language lab, and came out of the language lab, and where he'd been, I guess, isolated for an hour or however long the class ran, and the news had broken that he had been shot. I can't remember now whether he had been officially declared dead yet or not, or whether he was on the way to Parkland Hospital, and but soon enough the news was out that he was dead. I would, you know, I would say that the responses were in many ways similar. I mean, on a national level, there's a kind of level of shock. There's a question about who did this. Now, the Kennedy thing plays out over a few days with the capture of Oswald, and then Oswald's being shot. You know, one of the weird things, that weekend I was home with my parents, and we were watching the events on television, and this is, you know, one of those things. If you out there in 2100 are listening to this, it is true what I'm about to say. I was there, and they brought Ruby down from wherever they were holding him in Dallas, and I said to my folks, "My God, somebody's going to shoot him." In the sense that they came down and they were escorting him in a way that they had him maximally exposed to the cameras and the like, so I suppose the news media could see him. And then, you know, I don't know that I actually believe that. It was just that I was kind of surprised to see such an open view of him. And then the next thing you know, Jack Ruby steps forward and does shoot them. That was kind of one of those Twilight Zone moments. So that memory is very strong with me. I think the reaction I would say 9/11, because of subsequent events, in a way has had a more permanent effect. With Kennedy, it was a kind of it was a personal thing, you know, one that this could happen in the United States, and then whatever sympathy people had for Kennedy, you know, young man or with small children, all those personal elements that added to the dimension. Not that if he had been, you know, an older person or a single person or whatever, that still wouldn't have been shocked. But there was a kind of a motive because of his age and his status and, you know, and some of the magic that was associated with the early days of that presidency. I think it had a very strong emotional thing. But I'd say within a year or so, it wasn't that the event was forgotten, but it stood out as not a unique event in history. Other assassinations have occurred, but it did have something as, it was an oddity in a way. It was something unforeseeable, tragic. You might ask, well, what if Kennedy had lived and what would have happened with Vietnam and all those kind of speculations that came later. But for the most part, life went on. The goals, Johnson was able to, I think there were some reservations initially about Johnson's commitment to the programs that Kennedy had, but Johnson very ably, perhaps to a greater, maybe he had more luck, not more luck, but more good fortune, well, I guess it's the same thing, more luck getting through Congress or the obstructionists in Congress who might have stopped Kennedy weren't able to stop Johnson, in part probably because of the holdover emotions from Kennedy's death. But once that happened, then the society got wrapped up with other concerns not immediately connected with the death, like Vietnam, civil rights, and like, whereas with 9/11, this fear of, I think we tend to see it less as an extraordinary event perpetrated, unless you're a conspiracy theorist, by one person of perhaps less than stable qualities, whereas we see now 9/11 as a more purposeful event that may, unless we are extraordinarily vigilant, and even if we are extraordinarily vigilant, may or will be repeated. And we've had certainly wars coming directly and indirectly out of that, and concerns about extremism. And so in a way, that it's had a much longer shelf life than the Kennedy assassination had. But in the initial moments, I think the sort of the unity of the nation, the common mourning, the common concern, that was very, very similar, you know, provided you allow for certain differences of context and the like. And maybe that's what ticked me off partly when I got back here. It just seemed that, not that it was typical, I think what was happening here were just probably not even typical of the department, but that this kind of stuff was, these kinds of sort of old hat Madisonian political divisions were coming to the fore so soon after it that I, you know, it probably just rankled a bit more than it normally did.
So a couple more things. The first is, I mean, you just retired either late last year or early this year, however you want to look at it.
Yeah, so January 1st, technically, but that was for insurance reasons and pay reasons and all kinds of stuff.
So why retire then?
Why retire now? Well, I'm 72 years of age, and I just got to a point where I wouldn't say I'm certainly... You know that you got to retire sometime. I still, thank God, was in reasonably good health. I didn't see another logical point. I mean, you think 65, well, that's kind of the traditional age of retirement. 70, that's a nice round number. 72, although it didn't affect my finances or behavior, well, that's the time that, what is it, Social Security says that you could, well, at least in the old days, I think the rules were, well, you could collect Social Security even if you were still working. I mean, they've loosened the rules, but when I was a younger person, that was the stance. So that seemed to be a thing. Could I see myself going up to 75? Well, yeah, maybe. But then if you go to 75, why not 80? So it seemed as logical a moment as any. Many of the people of my cohort had retired or were retiring, and I didn't want to become kind of the old crank in the hallway or whatever. I think that the teaching had gotten a bit to me, in the sense that the main course that I teach, the immigration course, had, while I liked teaching it and the like, I was, I wouldn't say increasingly, but it had increasingly come to bother me that most students taking the course were taking it to fulfill their ethnic studies requirement and really had very little interest in the subject matter. Now, within that context, they were good sports, they studied, they did it, and the like, but still, you know, I was providing, I was bagging groceries for them, basically. You know, what the level of satisfaction was declining. And I didn't think it would be responsible to take graduate students on at this age. You know, people would be looking, at least in terms of applications, people would say, well, you know, I'd like to study with you or whatever. And just given the realities of life, this is a 7-8 year commitment. I couldn't see myself making commitments to graduate students because I wasn't sure what would happen when I go, or whether I would be replaced or not. Or not, you know, I'm sure that the free money will be used to hire somebody, that whether it be somebody in my fields or my interest, that who would be able to come in and provide what the person who came to study with me would need. Mm-hmm. I had no guarantee that would happen, and in all probability, I thought it wouldn't happen. So it seemed irresponsible in that regard. Part of my responsibility is, or a person here is, to be engaged in the training of graduate students and the like. And it just gotten to a point where it would have been, you know, morally irresponsible to sort of bring in graduate students, mm-hmm. and then abandon them. Mm-hmm. And I had stopped really dealing with. My last graduate student had finished this year, so the ones that I had, I stayed around long enough to get them all done. Those factors, I think, all came together to say, hey, this is as good a time as any to go out. My wife, who also worked, had sort of reached the same conclusion where she was doing that. It was, you know, she was ready to go out. I was willing to keep going as long as she wanted to keep going. I thought she'd probably go nuts if she were making the drive to go to work every day and I was living the whatever life it was. But no, it seemed if she was ready, then fine, why not? Okay. So all those kind of things came together.
Okay. Last question is sort of one of the legacy, which is, what do you think people will remember about you?
Well, almost nothing. I think they'll... I think in the long run, they won't remember very much about me at all. Just watching, we recently, there was a man named Alan Bogue, who was a history professor here and who had formative impacts on me when I was a younger man. He was a person whom I admired. I live near him and his wife. They're both now probably about in their 90s. They've been. She worked at the extension. She had a degree in history, and so history department knew her, and she just received like a lifetime award for her contributions, Margaret Bogue, for contributions to the history of the Middle West. Well, it's, obviously a very nice award and the like. But I was thinking, my God, who in this department, given the age structure now, knows who Margaret Bogue was? Mm-hmm. Unless you're in that thing. So I imagine that unless you're somebody like George Mossy and they name a building after you, or maybe Merrill Jensen, an extraordinarily famous guy, or Frederick Jackson Turner, who didn't finish up his days here, you're probably not in the long run going to be remembered beyond a few people who are maybe specialists in your field and who said, "Oh, I saw something by him once," or whatever. In the short term, I hope that the people who knew me say that he was a decent scholar. He contributed in the department in a very in a valued way. He was a good guy to have around. That would be nice if they felt like that about me. He made a contribution to the place. We were glad he was here. If in the short run of human memory they thought of me that way, I would be glad.
Tom, is there anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
No, not anything.
All right. Well, this concludes then the fourth and final interview with Dr. Thomas Archdeacon. Tom, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.